The Sochi Olympic Games ended on February 23rd. Soon thereafter, the U.S. ambassador to Russia stepped down from his post, flying home to California to spend more time with his family. And a couple of days later, Russia invaded Crimea. On Uncommon Knowledge today, the ambassador who stayed for the Games but missed the invasion, Mike McFaul. Uncommon Knowledge now. After taking up his post in January 2012, Michael McFaul stepped down as United States Ambassador to the Russian Federation this past February, just a couple of days before the Russians invaded Crimea. Born and raised in Montana, Ambassador McFaul holds a BA and an MA from Stanford University and a doctorate from Oxford, where he studied as a Rhodes Scholar. Ambassador McFaul spent 3 years as a foreign policy advisor to the Obama administration before becoming American envoy to Moscow. Now that he has left government service, Ambassador McFaul is once again a fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford. Ambassador McFaul, or since we've known each other a long time, if I may, Mike, welcome.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
What does the president of Russia think he's doing? Two quotations. One, asked to name the world leader he most admired, British politician Nigel Farage replied, quote, as an operator, but not as a human being, I would say Vladimir Putin. The way he played the whole Syria thing, brilliant. Close quote. Quotation number two, former Secretary of Defense Robert Gates on meeting Vladimir Putin, quote, I looked into Putin's eyes and just as I expected, I saw a stone cold killer. Close quote. What did Ambassador Michael McFaul see when he looked into Putin's eyes?
Well, I saw a very complex leader, and I think both of those quotes partially are right, but not fully right. He is a person who was thrust into the presidency. Let's be clear about that. He wasn't groomed to be president, and he was picked to be president. And so it took him a while.
Yeltsin picked him?
Yeltsin and his entourage, yes.
Oh, right.
And he was picked mostly because of his loyalty to Boris Yeltsin. And to Yeltsin's family. He wasn't picked because of his foreign policy orientation. He wasn't picked because of his ideas about economic reform. It was mostly that. And in the early years, he did some important economic reforms, by the way. But over time, I think we've come to see a couple of things that I think are most important if you want to understand who he is.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, his formative years as a professional was in the KGB. I think that's what Secretary
Gates... That's not just rumor.
That's real.
Thoroughly established.
Those are facts. And obviously, what that means is he fought hard, in his view, for the preservation and the Soviet Union and the strength of the Soviet Union. And he has said on the record that he laments the collapse of the Soviet Union. I think at one point he said it was the greatest tragedy of the 20th century. And that was a pretty tragic century. Second, he used to, I think he's flipped, and we'll get to this maybe when we talk about Crimea, but he used to accept the fact that the world is now different and Russia has to play by the rules of the game of international markets, capitalism, and the international rules of the game. And I would say until just the last several weeks ago when he finally decided, to hell with it all, I'm going to play by my own rules and I'm going to revise these rules, that he accepted that. And I think as president, especially in his first term, that was part of his game. But he always lamented it. He never liked it. He always had a big distrust of the West and the United States in particular, and me personally, by the way.
You personally. So KGB, he's a card-carrying communist. You don't get anywhere in the KGB without actually at least appearing to believe what the party teaches. Then he flipped and became at least tolerant of capitalism. There's money floating around Russia. And he also, at least in recent years particularly, last couple of years since becoming president again, has been talking quite a lot about the importance of the Orthodox Christian tradition in Russia. So you've got a man who used to be opposed to markets, who's now open to them, who used to believe in an official atheism, who now believes in, or at least gives lip service to, Christianity. So the only Where he hasn't changed, I'm asking, this is all long question, yeah. but it's the form of a question. What's consistent in him is some kind of belief in or loyalty to some notion of the greatness of Russia. Is that fair?
I think it's fair. And the greatness of Russia is the key piece, no longer the Soviet Union. So as he has been in power, and as he has become more conservative socially and his relationship with the Russian Orthodox Church, you're absolutely right about
that. That's important.
I think it is very important. He's also resurrected Tsarist history and Tsarist greatness, not just Soviet greatness. And that's a change. He didn't used to talk that way. He talks that way now. In fact, recently he's talked about mistakes that Bolsheviks had made. Khrushchev made a mistake when he gave Crimea away to Ukraine. Mm-hmm. And that was part of the justification for him annexing Crimea. And most recently, in a real revisionist history way of thinking, he's talked about the mistake that the Bolsheviks made in giving away this territory called Nova Russia, New Russia, which is eastern Ukraine. And just last week in a telephone call-in show, he said, why did they do that? That was a mistake. So he's going back to emphasizing the imperial era as opposed to the Soviet era.
I see. We'll come to Crimea, obviously. But Russia faces a long-term challenge in the east from a rising China. Along its southern tier, it has one Muslim nation after another. It faces a challenge from radical Islam. The United States faces both of those challenges. Those are long-term, big, strategic challenges. Why on earth shouldn't he have made a special effort to befriend us rather than to seem to, he seems almost like de Gaulle in the sense that he is carving out his identity on the world stage in opposition to the United States. How can that make sense for Russian national interests?
Well, there's no doubt in my mind that Putin worries about those threats you just described. I've sat across the table, I've listened to him talk, and I think in his first term as president, when dealing with President Bush and with President Obama, references to our common interests, especially in terms of fighting terrorism, and nuclear threats from other countries has been part of an agenda that has been shared. But you said, why would he want to define himself in opposition to us on the international stage? Mm-hmm. And I would correct you to say, he's not worried about the international stage. He's worried about the domestic stage. Okay. And the reason that he has pivoted away from the West and recreated this enemy called the United States of America in his eyes has mostly to do with domestic politics and only a little bit to do with foreign policy. And let me explain. In the fall, December 2011, there was an election for parliament in Russia that was falsified, like most elections in Russia over the last 15, 20 years. Only this time, people had the technology to discover and uncover that falsification. And it triggered hundreds of thousands of people on the streets in Moscow and other big cities, in the first instance criticizing and protesting against the election, but more generally calling for more democracy, more openness, a different kind of political system. It scared Putin. It scared his regime. And they didn't know how to respond. They had a debate about it. President Medvedev at the time wanted to work with the protesters and do some marginal reforms. When President Putin was eventually elected, he said, no, we're going to crack down on these protesters. We're going to crack down on these people that are threatening me and my regime. And part of the crackdown, part of the way we're going to discredit them is to call them traitors, is to say that they are the instruments of American foreign policy. And so he has a theory about us that we are fomenting political opposition to him.
He believes that?
He believes it.
He does believe it.
I used to think it was just for electoral political reasons, but then he won the election. It's like, okay, shut it down, guys, and they didn't. And to this day, he has a fear about us trying to undermine him. And I experienced it personally. I was the, in his eyes, I was the orchestrator of this revolution against him.
Well, okay, you say you experienced it personally. He was cold to you. He was a raving paranoiac and said, why are you trying to attack me? How did you experience it? Or did he send intermediaries to say, Ambassador, you'd better watch out. You better not have your country do this or this. What form did that take?
All of the above.
Oh, really?
In the first blush, it was in the media. And so what would happen in the media is they would have me on and say, he's an expert on the Orange Revolution, on color revolution, sent here to foment revolution in our country.
They'd say that in the intro?
Oh, yeah.
I should have put that in, Mike.
Day two, my second day of work in Moscow, this was a feature on the most watched television program in Russia. And went into long explanation for why Obama sent me to on this mission. They put out a calendar, I remember, in 2012 called McFall's Girls, where I featured on it on page one, and then January, February, March was a different opposition leader dressed up in some kind of 1950s calendar.
So they haven't actually gotten better at propaganda since the old days. It's still pretty ham-fisted.
It was pretty Soviet-like. And the biggest demonstration that led to people being arrested happened May 6, 2012. And many of those people are still in jail today. I think it's right to call them political prisoners, which you haven't had in Russia for a long time. That day, there were posters put up all over the city called... The political circus is coming again to the stage, and featured a photo of me next to all these other opposition leaders. So in terms of media, it was very direct. And on occasion, it was direct from Putin himself in meetings with me, where he said, I know what you're doing here, and we're going to stop you. Complete nonsense, right? We did not have a policy of regime change. We were not giving money to the opposition. It wasn't the policy of the administration to do so.
Mike, before you mentioned Medvedev, if I pronounced that even close to correctly a moment ago, Putin is president for two four-year terms. Then he steps down. Medvedev becomes president for 1 four-year term. By the way, Putin does this, correct me if I'm wrong, but Putin does this to observe at least the form of the new
correct.
Russian constitution, which says 2 terms and then you step down.
Yeah.
And then he came back and has been reelected. He's now in his first non-contiguous, so to speak, third term, so to speak.
All right.
You made progress. You personally, and the Obama administration, I have heard you argue, made progress with Medvedev. The reset policy worked. Explain what you mean when you say that.
So it did work, as defined by us and our national interests. The reset was a simple concept, which when we came into office in January of 2009, we looked at the problems around the world that we wanted to tackle. And in several instances, not all, but in several instances, our theory was if Russia is working with us, we're more likely to achieve our outcome than if Russia is working against us.
Right.
And so we set out on a course of engagement with President Medvedev to try to realize these outcomes. And, I think we got some big things done. We signed a New START treaty that brings down the number of nuclear weapons on the one hand, but most importantly for me, allowed for inspections to continue so that we know exactly what the Russian arsenal is. Trust but verify, as Ronald Reagan said. I had a trust but verify button on my desk for 5 years in my time in government.
His pen happens to say trust but verify. I'll show you after.
Okay, great. Well, I wanted to be reminded of that every single day.
Right.
Number two, the threat from Iran. Number one threat in 2009, I still think it's one of the greatest threats to America and our allies. So we worked with Russia to try to prevent Iran from acquiring a nuclear weapon. First in a more cooperative way, but then we got Russia to sign up for the most comprehensive set of sanctions against Iran ever. And in my view, without those sanctions, we don't have the negotiations we have today. Third, Afghanistan. When we came into office, almost all of our supply lines to our troops in Afghanistan went through the southern route, through Pakistan. A trickle went through the north.
Mm-hmm.
We increased that, called the Northern Distribution Network, so that by the time I left government, it was about half of our supplies came through the northern routes, including
Russia. Which means what,
Russia.
We have the permission to land in Russia and transship by ground supplies into Afghanistan? They're letting us land there? We have overflight rights? How does that work?
Planes, trains, trucks, the whole nine yards.
We get to use a big chunk of their territory.
Right. Mostly trains, stuff being offloaded from Virginia, then getting on tracks in Lithuania, going through Russia and Central Asia and Afghanistan, but also overflight as well. American troops flying through Russian territory on their way to fight in Afghanistan.
And for a country that is very touchy about its territory, that's a big concession.
Big deal, and lethal transit as well. And I would just remind you why that was so important, because we've had some tense periods in our bilateral relationship with Pakistan, particularly right after our administration went in and took out Mr. bin Laden. And we were worried, rightly, that those supply routes would be interrupted if we got into disagreements with our colleagues in Pakistan. This gave us leverage to do that. Number four, we got Russia into the World Trade Organization. That constrains their behavior in terms of just playing by the international rules of the game. And there are, you know, many more minor things.
So Medvedev, why is Medvedev? The take, this is just any casual reader of the press, The Economist, The Wall Street Journal, the take during those years was that Medvedev was still acting on Putin's behalf.
Yes.
Putin moved to prime minister, Medvedev was president. So during this period when Medvedev is being cooperative, is it Putin being cooperative? Or is Medvedev carving out his own sphere of authority? To what extent was that Russia being cooperative with us? And to what extent was it Medvedev whom the moment he stepped down, we simply lost the opportunity?
You know, it's a great question, and I don't have a great answer because it's mysterious to me to this day. What I would say is the assumption you just described was, of course, our assumption in the government. We assume that when Medvedev signed up for sanctions against Iran, that Putin supported it. Right. We assume that he supported the WTO. We assumed he supported this new arms control treaty. But I think over time, in retrospect, we underestimated how autonomous Medvedev was.
I see.
And when we learned about that was over Libya. Because over on Libya, when we went to the Security Council to get support for those military actions, UN Security Council Resolution 1970 and 1973, Russia abstained. Medvedev abstained, to be more accurate, and we worked very hard to achieve those abstentions. And for the first time ever, Putin publicly criticized him for doing that. And I think that was the beginning of the end for President Medvedev. But then I would add one more piece, that without those demonstrations, without the internal challenge to Putin, there might have been more continuity in foreign policy. But once that happened and he became so focused on his domestic problems, he needed an enemy. And obviously, given our history, we were the natural one for him to pull out of this.
Because for 1,000 years, the imperative for Russian rulers has been the maintenance of order. Again, all this is taking the form of a question. And in the most modern period, we see the Cold War end, the Soviet Union becomes officially defunct at the end of 1991, Yeltsin becomes president, and instead of a flowering of a liberal democracy and a free market society, thugs emerge, start ripping off state enterprises, the first oligarchs begin to emerge, the democracy leads to chaos, the economy collapses, In fact, the living standards declined so sharply that the death rate actually was a mess. Mm-hmm. And so Putin says, I have 1,000 years of Russian history telling me the first duty of a ruler of this country is order. I have an experience in the early 1990s that was horrific. And I see all around the world these new electronic, the internet, the Twitter. I see the uprising in Cairo. I see what happened in Libya. That must not happen here. Is that what he's thinking?
More or less. I mean, he's wrong. His theory of history is wrong. I want to make that clear. All the evils you just described, I would blame the Soviet legacy for that. You have 70 years of communism. It's going to take some time to unravel that. And that happened in Russia. It happened throughout the post-communist world. But other countries...
What about the Chinese model, though, Mike? Putin is saying to himself, look, the Chinese got it right. They retained tight control.
We'll see.
And then gradually opened up the markets.
Well, we'll see.
No? Isn't that a plausible? Don't you think that?
That's his view.
All right.
But China's got a lot of history in front of them. China is not as industrialized and as educated as the Soviet Union was in the late 1980s. And I'm not an expert on China, but the comparison falls short for me because they're not where the Soviet Union was before. But that is definitely his view. In terms of describing his view, most certainly. And remember, the last time there were hundreds of thousands of people on the street in Moscow was 1991. That's in the back of his mind. And number two, Arab Spring, the color revolutions, right? Ukraine in 2004, Georgia 2003, Serbia in 2000, where you had massive demonstrations that led to the fall of these dictators. He's worried about that, and therefore he's going to crack down. And he's worried about us helping those protesters against him.
Okay, and that's why he responded as he did to the protests. To the protests in Kiev. That was precisely the kind of thing that he could not permit to have happen. And now it's happening in Ukraine, which he views as within the Russian sphere. All right, this brings us to Crimea and Ukraine. Mike McFaul in a recent interview, quote, Putin may have picked up Crimea, but he's lost Ukraine forever. That's not a very good trade, a pawn for a queen. Explain that.
That was a clever one, huh?
That was a good one. Left right off the page.
Well, before this current crisis, tragedy I would call it, not crisis, but before this current tragedy, Putin had a different agenda. He was trying to recreate Russian economic hegemony in the space that used to be called the Soviet Union. And his primary instrument for that is something called the Eurasia Economic Union. His equivalent of the European Union, right? And whether how coercive it is, we could argue about, but that was his main foreign policy objective. And key to making that work was to have Ukraine in it. You know, it's one thing to have Belarus in it. It's another thing to have the giant economy with 45 million people of Ukraine. And he was trying to put that together. And last fall, he had a major victory when President Yanukovych, the president of Ukraine, declined to sign an accession agreement with the European Union. And cost him $15 billion, by the way. There was a figure for him not to sign that the Russians agreed to. And Putin thought he had won. And this was good for his overall agenda. But in February of this year, after fighting between the opposition and the regime, bloody fighting where both sides lost people, they tried to put together a compromise agreement between Yanukovych and the opposition. And by they, I mean the Europeans, but also supported by us and supported by Russia. And that agreement from February 21st fell apart. Yanukovych fled for reasons I don't quite understand, by the way. But he fled, eventually landed up in Russia. Mm-hmm. And that's when Putin changed his strategy. That's when he realized that he was losing all of Ukraine. So now was his, in a kind of reaction to that, that's when he decided to go for Crimea.
How far does he want to go? Does he want eastern Ukraine as well as Crimea? Does he want to secure the rim of the Black Sea? Does he want to go over to Odessa?
I don't know.
You don't know?
No. And I don't believe anybody who pretends to know. What I see Putin doing is keeping that option open. By the way, this is quite consistent with his decision-making. He likes to keep his options open. He likes optionality. And so what you have today is you have these masked green men, that they're called, who are obviously serving the purposes of the Kremlin, declaring independence in eastern Ukraine. And they serve, they're an instrument, they're a means to serve two different objectives. The immediate objective is to destabilize the government of Kiev and to make it harder for them to govern and to make the upcoming presidential election for May 25th harder to pull off. The longer term objective may be setting up the pretext or predicate for annexation that you just described. I don't think today Putin's made up his mind. I don't think he's decided what he wants to do, but he's keeping his options open to do but the latter for sure.
Mike, a few other ways of looking at Vladimir Putin. Henry Kissinger suggested in a piece in the Washington Post not long ago, not justifying the annexation of Crimea, but he's suggesting that with a little historical knowledge, we might not have found it so surprising. He notes that Kiev, not Moscow, is the birthplace of Russia historically. And this is a quotation from Henry Kissinger. Even such famed dissidents as Alexander Solzhenitsyn and Joseph Brodsky insisted that Ukraine was an integral part of Russian history and indeed of Russia. Close quote. Kissinger said, Ukraine's only been independent for 23 years. For centuries, it's a part of Russia. For other centuries, it's going back and forth under different foreign rulers. So Vladimir Putin may not be in favor with you, but he has Alexander Solzhenitsyn and Joseph Brodsky, a liberal figure, and Joseph Brodsky on his side. What does Mike McFaul do with that?
Well, the historical background of Crimea and the relationship to Ukraine and Russia, I don't disagree with that, although many Ukrainians would disagree with that, by the way. To say that the origins of Russia was Kiev is not something you should say to Ukrainian historians. But let's leave that aside. Where do you stop when you go back in history? You know, when you start unraveling things and saying, we need to correct this wrong and that wrong, where do you stop? You know, does that mean that Mexico should be able to get New Mexico and parts of southern Southwest America back because we seized it illegally 150 years ago? Where do you stop with that? And all this cultural affinity and historical sharedness, well, we have a lot of shared history with Canada. Does that give us a right to invade and annex Canada? Of course not. That's absurd. And I think the international system that was set up to deal precisely with stopping autocrats from annexing territory, that is the post-World War II international system, has served stability and security well. Whereas if you start opening this Pandora's box that everybody gets to annex anything based on some claim from the past, I think that's a very dangerous precedent.
Stephen Cohen, professor at Princeton, serious figure in Russian, as a Russian historian, Soviet, and here's a longish quotation from last March. Bear with me on the quotation, but it encapsulates a point of view. Stephen Cohen, professor emeritus of Princeton. I began warning everyone in 1990 when Clinton began to move NATO toward Russia, that this was going to lead to exactly what it's led to. We hit Russia's borders under Bush because the Baltic republics became NATO members. Now we've crossed Russia's red line in Ukraine. Let's say tomorrow that Russian power shows up in Canada, on our border, and in Mexico. Do we just say then, oh, every people has the right to decide its own future? Do we say that? We, not Putin, have managed to move the divide of the Cold War from Berlin, where it was semi-safe, right to Russia's borders. Putin didn't bring this on. It was the last thing he wanted. It's the fault of the White House. Mike McFaul in the White House for 3 years before going to Moscow. It's the fault of the White House and the Congress and the EU, close quote. We provoked them. They are a great country, they have interests, and we got in their faces.
Obviously, I disagree. I find it fanciful to say that we forced Putin to annex Crimea. This was not inevitable. This was not part of a 20-year or 200-year, you know, march of history. And I would just remind you that just a month before the annexation of Crimea, Putin hadn't made any big speech about how it was necessary. NATO expansion was not an issue just a year ago. Whether that's good or bad, but NATO had not been expanding for the last 5 years. And moreover, it was the EU expansion that was the drama, the trigger of this drama. It was not NATO.
Economic rather than military.
And so, you know, are we now going to say we can't have economic arrangements? We can't have trading arrangements? Russia, after all, is creating the Eurasia Economic Union. Does anybody have any beef with that? Should we say that's illegitimate? You don't have a right to do that? So I just think this blame the West for Putin's bad behavior, you know, it's kind of a, it just doesn't, it misses the contingency of the moment that we were in at the time. And number two, if you go back to the early period of Europe, what's the alternative to NATO expansion at the time? You gotta have an argument to say, well, we would have been better with this. And my counterfactual is, imagine had we not expanded NATO. Imagine a Europe with no NATO, had we just disbanded it like some people said we should have done. Think of how unstable Eastern Europe would feel today with what Russia is doing. Thankfully, there is a NATO, and thankfully that does create some hard red lines where we're not worrying
about.
We
have red lines.
Well, I think Russia, I think it's much less likely that Russia will invade Lithuania or Latvia or Estonia because of NATO. And
okay.
That's a good thing in my view.
So what next is the question. What next in Europe? What next? What should we do next? You're the Prime Minister of Poland. What are you thinking?
Well, thankful. I'm sure they're thanking President Clinton that he expanded NATO, first and foremost, and that that was a wise decision that brought them in and made them a whole part of Europe. A very important actor in Europe right now, by the way. Good for us, too, that we have Poland as an ally. I think we're in for a long standoff with Russia in that part of the world. I don't think NATO's at threat, and I think we're now doing, the administration and the NATO alliance are doing the right things to guarantee the sovereignty and the security of the states in NATO, and I applaud that. And I think the real drama will remain in Ukraine. Will Ukraine make it as a state? Will Ukraine make it as an economy? That I think there will be fighting intellectually and economically and hopefully not militarily, but I think the drama over Ukraine will be the focus of Europe and the West's attention in that part of the world for years, if not decades to come.
Mike, from your piece in the New York Times earlier this spring, quote, "Now democratic societies need to recognize Mr. Putin's role for what it is, autocracy, and embrace the intellectual and normative struggle against this system with the same vigor we summoned during previous struggles in Europe against anti-democratic governments," close quote. You're not serious. You don't mean that we should become as worked up about Vladimir Putin as we were about Hitler or Mussolini or Stalin. Do you really?
He's not that much of a danger.
Okay.
And later in that piece, I explain why he's not, because he doesn't have the same means and he doesn't have a...
And he has no real allies. You made that
critical
point.
He has no allies. And number three, he doesn't have an ideology that appeals to anybody outside of Russia and maybe parts of Eastern Ukraine. Even in Eastern Ukraine, he's not winning the votes out there. The majority want to remain in Ukraine, an important point that he's not even winning there in terms of the intellectual arguments. But what I do mean is I think we need to re-engage and with more vigor the reasons we believe in democracy and free markets and the power of the individual and propagate and be involved in the intellectual discussion about those ideas, because I think we've been a little sheepish about it. We've been a little shy about it. At the same time that countries like Russia have been putting in hundreds of millions of dollars in resources to propagate. Propagate's not a good word for us, but it is a good word for them, to promote their interpretation of what the United States is doing.
Okay. Mike, you just said that Ukraine is still the test, right? Okay.
Yes.
Now, the question that falls under a couple of other questions, but the large question is, so what? Why should we care? Poland itself spends less than 2% of its GDP on military. There's not a country in Europe that spends as much as 3%. The British are up to 2.3. The French, I think, are at 2.3 as well. We're at 4.7%. For seven decades after the end of the Second World War, we have been protecting those people. That's asking a lot. Suppose Putin keeps Crimea. Suppose he gets half of Ukraine. The western half breaks away. They come to some arrangement. Suppose that happens. Suppose he gets the Transdniester bit of Moldova. Suppose he goes as far as Odessa. Suppose he keeps the northern couple of bits of Georgia. From the Americans' point of view, so what? Can't we live with that?
Well, again,
I'm just hitting you with everything, let me make sure I hit you with everything. Taking the long view of 1,000 years of Russian history, you call Vladimir Putin an autocrat. He's been elected 3 times. He stepped down from office to observe at least the form of the new Russian constitution. Every poll I can find suggests that he is overwhelmingly popular in Russia now. There was a poll the other day that indicated that his popularity is now at 80%.
Yeah.
He has his people with him right up until 1991, as you say, in 1,000 years of Russian history, there hadn't been a single elected leader. This man has at least observed the forms of democracy enough to hold elections 3 times. This is progress. They have to work through in a few more decades. Let's just bear with them. That's the counterargument. Mm-hmm. So how do you answer all that?
Well, I would say a couple of things. First, it will be a very unstable world if we return to empires and countries can just begin to annex and invade and take over countries because of the national interest or some historic wrong. Because there's lots of other countries in the world that will then see fit to do that themselves. So I think that's very dangerous. Number two, the long history of the United States, I think, shows that our closest allies in the world have been democracies, and our only threats have been autocracies. We don't go to war with democracies. We go to war with autocracies or autocratic social movements like Al-Qaeda, right? That is, therefore, it does matter to us who rules in Russia and what those autocratic regimes might do to our allies in Europe. So I think we have some pretty big stakes here. It doesn't mean that all the burden, to the earlier part of your question, has to be on us. I think there does need to be a real debate within the alliance now about who spends what. And ironically, Putin has now complained many times about NATO. NATO was off the table for a while. Now it's back, right? It's right. NATO and Nazis, by the way, NATO and Nazis. And yet his actions has done more than any single event in the last 20 years to reinvigorate the NATO alliance. I mean, they were in trouble in terms of what is their mission, especially with the pullback in Afghanistan. He has now made very clear to at least some Europeans why the alliance is necessary.
Mike, last question. Vladimir Putin has another couple of years to run in this term. Everybody expects him to run again and serve out. So let's say he's going to be president for 6 more years. He will see out President Obama. What is your advice to Vladimir Putin? If I could guarantee that he would listen, he wouldn't interrupt you, he wouldn't put up posters around Moscow, if I could guarantee that Vladimir Putin would listen to you closely and take seriously your advice, what would you say to him?
Don't invade Eastern Ukraine. Because in the long run, if you want to make Russia great, you need Russia to be a respected power in the world and a rich power. And if you invade Eastern Ukraine, you will not be respected and you won't be rich. And I would appeal to his own, focus on Russia's greatness, that would be detrimental. And third, and I know he would laugh at this, or no, he wouldn't laugh, he would say partly what you said in your previous question. I am a Democrat, but I would say to him, open up your society, liberalize, allow for real elections, not ones that you control. Because in the long run, that's the source of stability, that's the source of economic growth, because democracy and growth go together, and that's the way that you will attract and inspire the best and the brightest in your country. Russia should be great, powerful, prosperous. I want that Russia, as long as it's also a democratic Russia, because that Russia will be a stable, and we won't always agree, but will be a stable and partner to the United States and the rest of the democratic world. And in the long run, real patriots of Russia should believe in that Russia, not the Russia that we're tinkering on in today's world.
Michael McFaul, until just 2 months ago, the United States Ambassador to the Russian Federation, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
And welcome back to Stanford.
Thanks.
For the Hoover Institution and the Wall Street Journal, I'm Peter Robinson.